Well, I had these two teachers that had a constitutional point of view, and then all these other people that practiced acupuncture from what I call a conditional point of view. And what I came to is, for myself, is the idea that when we come into life, we start out with a particular configuration of our energetics on every level. And that's just a reflection of who we are. That's our original nature. And we feel like ourselves when we're keeping that original nature, because that's who we are. And it feels, we call that being healthy. Doesn't mean you don't have problems, but that's being healthy. If because of any outside or inside disruption, you lose that original orientation, you then don't have your original nature anymore. You're thrown off of it.
I'm Michael Max, and this is Cheological, the podcast that curates East Asian medicine and methods through the power of conversation. You can ponder the question of why, or put yourself into the active exploration of why not. For sure, the latter question will bring you more trouble. It will also have you cracking the seams of beliefs that held the limit of what's possible. Open up potentials that others for sure will warn you as a one-way ticket to disaster, and invite potentials that in time can ripen into seemingly overnight success or stunning imaginative breakthroughs. But it's never an overnight process. It's the unfolding inquiries of what, how, and when that lead to transformative change over time. I suspect these are the three most potent questions to keep in mind when looking to do something new or to make a change from the status quo. Why is rarely helpful. It tends to loop into either accusation or excuse. Why puts you at odds with the forces of inertia and homeostasis. You'll be able to rally a mob with why, but if you really want change, if transformation is the aim, then what and how? Those questions show you the fulcrums of influence, like an accurate diagnosis illuminates the points that hold the potency for influencing a person's trajectory. And then there is considering timing, knowing the flow of the tides, the rhythms of filling and emptying, of being able to discern where the current is swift and how flows are rarely singular, but part of larger, complex, and interactive systems. Knowing the when is having a sense of the tempo of a situation, like a musician can feel into music or a forester knows the long tides of trees. All questions contain the possibility of change. They all direct attention in particular ways. They are portals that open the fractal edges of awareness. Want to change the world? Maybe. Lean less on answers and more on the potency of questions, especially the ones for which you think you've already got an answer. Some people have a spirit that moves upward and outward. They tend to be restless. Others are more quiescent. They excel at accepting what is. And then there are those in the middle. They tend to be fueled by a wellspring of curiosity. Curiosity is not trying to change the world. It's not asking for things to be different. Curiosity is trying to understand and see the inner workings of God's imagination. It seeks the connection between parts and wholes. It leans on questions and thrives on discovery. Curiosity will always have you trading your cow for a handful of magic beans. Peter Ekman is one of those people who thrives on curiosity. You'll see it in his writing as he traces the footsteps of one of his influential teachers, J.R. Worsley, in which he explores the influences that J.R. wove into his perspective on acupuncture. It shows up in the depth of Peter's study of Korean medicine and how his inquisitiveness around the pulse took him into the Ayurvedic tradition. Peter has spent a lifetime in exploring medicine through the practice of it and by constantly leaning into the questions that arise. As science fiction writer Isaac Asimov said, all great discoveries arise not from "Eureka, I've found it," but rather, "Huh, that's strange." I had an opportunity to visit with Peter in person on a recent visit to the city of St. Francis by the Bay. I am looking forward to sharing this with you. Don't touch that dial. We'll be right back. These conversations come to you through the generous support of our sponsors and members. All the sponsors here provide helpful products or services that you'll find beneficial in your clinical work. Worried that an EMR is too complex for you? Jane has friendly and knowledgeable support. Mayway Herbs is celebrating the 55th year of their family business. You're invited to make use of their vast library of resources. Are you concerned about the health of Mother Earth? AccuFast Needles is doing something about that. You can too. And later in the show, Ancestral Sturman offers up a sinew treatment, and the folks at Blue Poppy have something special to share as well. Do be sure to visit the sponsors page on the Geological website to take advantage of all the special offers our terrific sponsors have for listeners of the podcast. I don't know about you, but sometimes I take a step back and marvel at my acupuncture needles. I mean, they're the world's simplest medical tool. A sharpened wire and a handle. That's it. And with this simple tool, hundreds of health conditions can be resolved. I love it. What I didn't love was the amount of packaging waste I generated at the end of the day. But that has now changed too. Ever since I switched to AccuFast Earth-Friendly Needles, I reduced my packaging waste by 90%. Not only are they a great needle, but the folks at AccuFast plant a tree for every two boxes of needles I use in the clinic. By switching to AccuFast Needles, you'll be helping patients, planting trees, and joining a community of practitioners changing the world. Like our simple needle, being a part of the solution, it's simple too. Visit AccuFastNeedles.com/geological to learn how.
Hi folks, I'm Yvonne Lau, president of Mayway Herbs. Our family business turns 55 this year, and we wouldn't have gotten this far without the love and support of our community. We're truly grateful and promise you that we'll continue to work hard to support you and your practice. Please visit Mayway.com to find the perfect Pumsar brand formula or formulate your own in our dispensary. Our site also has lots of articles, videos, and herbal recipes for you to explore. And tune into our podcast, Chinese Medicine Matters, for insightful discussions on all things TCM. Learn about treatment strategies and powerful herbal remedies. As we welcome the month of May, our focus is on women's health. Our newsletter articles and podcast episodes this month will highlight different aspects and unique challenges women face. So subscribe or tune in. And if you're a practitioner, get a discount on our women's health formulas this month. Just visit Mayway.com. This season and every season, trust Mayway Herbs for your health and wellness needs. And thank you for supporting Real Chinese Medicine.
I love how technology can help to automate my office, and I want to share with you my favorite tool for doing so, Jane. Jane is a clinic management software in EMR with a human touch. Whether you're switching your software or going paperless for the first time, the Jane team knows that the onboarding process can feel a little overwhelming. That's why with Jane, you don't just get software, you get a whole team. Included in every Jane subscription is their award-winning customer support available by phone, email, and chat whenever you need it, even Saturdays. You can also book a free account setup consultation to review your account and ensure you feel confident about going live. If you're interested in making the switch to Jane, head to jane.app/switch to book a one-on-one demo with a member of their support team. And be sure to mention the code CHEOLOGICAL at the time of sign up for a one-month grace period on your new Jane account. Peter Ekman, welcome to CHEOLOGICAL.
Thank you, Michael.
Always wonderful to hang out with you. It's been a long time. You were on years ago. In fact, I think it was before CHEOLOGICAL. I think we talked back on Everyday Acupuncture.
Could be. We've done a couple of CHEOLOGICAL broadcasts, and then we had an in-person meeting prior to that.
Yes, we had sushi. That was delicious. Today we're sitting down to talk some about the history, because you were kind of in the profession before we actually had a profession. And it's such a fascination to me. I came along in the 90s. There were schools, there was licensure, there was a career path, I guess you could say. Back when you started, there weren't career paths. I don't think there were even schools. I'm curious, Peter, let's get in the Wayback Machine for a moment. I'd like to know about the landscape of what you were living in. What was happening? What was in the news? What were the issues of the day? What was going on when you first heard about acupuncture?
Okay, so let's do a word of, what's the word, relevance for the listeners about where I'm coming from, which is I was a medical doctor at the time, so I did MD and PhD program in physiology at New York University, which ended in 1972, I believe. So I did like 7 years in postgraduate school. And in that process, I pretty much had realized I didn't like any of the options for practicing Western medicine. In 73, I moved from New York to San Francisco to do my medical internship, which is a basic requirement for getting licensure as a physician. So even though during that internship year, I pretty much figured out that I wasn't going to do any kind of residency program because I didn't like the options, but I also really didn't like the hierarchical nature of medical training in Western medicine. I had been in school for so many years, I needed a break. And so around the time that I found out about acupuncture was when I had just finished my internship training in 1973. So the landscape at that time was most people didn't really know anything about acupuncture, but I made some cheat notes here to remind me of dates and stuff. So let me take a quick look at it. But if I remember properly, I think that 1971 was when Nixon made his trip to China. Even though there was some popular understanding of acupuncture being a thing in the early 1970s, it was pretty limited, and it was just beginning. So what happened was in 71, James Reston made his trip to China. He was a New York Times reporter who was kind of preparing the way for Nixon's visit to China. And he was hoping to really be the prime reporter on that event. And
turns out he was.
Well, he was and he wasn't.
Unexpected ways.
Yeah, in unexpected ways. What happened was while he was there in China in 71, he heard that Henry Kissinger had just been appointed by Nixon to be the actual spokesperson for setting up Nixon's visit, and that basically kind of was scooping him, that Reston would have much less of an interaction with the Chinese authorities. You know, this is back in the days when there was really a bamboo curtain that, you know, we really had no contact with China pretty much prior to Nixon. So when Reston heard that Kissinger was going to take his prime spot, he, within 24 hours, came down with acute appendicitis and ended up in the hospital. And he had conventional surgery to get his appendix out, which had burst. But he had a certain amount of postoperative pain and ileus, meaning his bowels weren't working, and was asked if he wanted to have acupuncture to treat that, help him feel better and get his body working again. And he said, yeah, I'll do that. And it turned out to be, I think he had 3 needles inserted by his practitioner, and it turned out to be very positive. He liked it and felt that it really helped him. And that eventuated in his New York Times column about acupuncture, which is really what hit Americans, you know, I think even more so than Nixon's visit, touching on acupuncture, which was pretty much nil. You know, Nixon's visit was a political visit. It wasn't really about medicine.
It turned out to be about cultural exchange with Rustin. It's interesting. I didn't know that he had originally seen himself in a higher position.
Well,
Kissinger,
I think
comes in, and then he comes down with this appendicitis.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting story.
It's kind of a livery thing, isn't it?
In many ways, one of the most important is the implication that emotions play such a big part in health. And, you know, when you make that connection, and this is, Rustin himself made this connection. He's the one that said, as soon as I heard that Kissinger was going to take over, he was coming in, that's when I felt this pain in my abdomen. And I you know, clearly felt like my upset at that was what caused my appendicitis, which, you know, that's an amazing connection that Western medicine is still struggling to catch up with.
Yes, and so fundamental to our medicine.
Yeah, yeah. For Asian medicine, yes, but Western medicine is, you know, behind in that spot.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I've talked to quite a few people now, and often they will ping on, oh, yeah, Rustin is when it first came into my consciousness. So that was a couple of years. You were probably still at NYU at that point. A few years later, you're out here, 73, you're out in San Francisco, you're doing this, was it internship?
Yeah, my medical internship was in 73.
You're not particularly pleased with where you're headed, but you're going to finish your degree off, which is not a bad idea.
Finish
where
licensure.
Does acupuncture come into your life in San Francisco?
Yeah, so what was happening was I finished in 73 my internship, and took some time off because, as I said, it had been many, many years that I'd just been a student or an internship practitioner. And while I was kind of just hanging out, you know, trying to figure out what to do with my life.
How old are you at this point?
That's a good question.
Roughly.
I was born in 1945, and this is 1973, you can figure it out as well as I can.
Oh, I'm terrible with math.
I'm pretty terrible with math, but the listeners can figure it out.
There we go.
Anyway, I'm hanging out, just kind of figuring out where to go with my life, and also feeling like this is vacation time for me. And the wife of one of my friends here in San Francisco came around one day and showed me a want ad in the San Francisco Chronicle, our local newspaper, for a licensed physician who's interested in working in an acupuncture clinic in Los Angeles that was set up by a retired OBGYN doctor who was setting up actually a string of acupuncture clinics manned by Korean practitioners who at that time were not legally allowed to practice in the United States or in California anyway. And they needed licensed physicians to actually put needles in people. So I had no income at that time. You know, I had pretty much run out of my financial resources. I knew nothing about acupuncture other than I had read Reston's article in the paper. But I had a good friend who was one of my co-interns from that year who came from Los Angeles. He had moved back there, and he said, why don't you come live with me? You know, we'll get an apartment together. So I did that. I interviewed first. I went down there and interviewed, And I mean, they basically just wanted somebody with a license, so the interview was a snap. And they said, yeah, if you want the job, it's yours.
You're going to stick needles in people.
Right.
We're going to tell you where to stick them.
Yeah, the way it worked was they had hired this bunch of Korean practitioners to come to Los Angeles, and they set up a two-week training course for the Western medical doctors who were, except for me, pretty much, I think, close to 100% of them were retired doctors just looking for something to do that was easy. It was a two-week course from the Korean practitioners through a translator in the basics of acupuncture so that we would get a feeling for it. And my sense at the time was first that there was a lot of what was missing in the practice of medicine about acupuncture that appealed to me. It had a feeling, I had at the time that I still have now is that the practice of medicine shares a lot with the appreciation of poetry and music, and that was almost non-existent in Western medical training. There was never a sense that those things were part of what a doctor does. Whereas in Asian medicine and acupuncture, they were very central to, you know, the color, sound, odor, emotion kind of associations with the elements. All of that is poetry and music.
It's all in there. So you're just looking for something to do. This job looks okay. You get tossed into a two-week training. In that 2 weeks, pieces that were not in your Western training, you're like, this makes sense. This sounds right.
Let me hold you up on that, because it wasn't so much that it makes sense holds up. It was, I like this. Do I believe it? No, this is never going to work. This is totally bananas. You know, they can tell, they were paying me to do this.
I liked it, but it's bananas.
Exactly. I liked it, but it's bananas. You know, it's like going to a Woody Allen comedy routine. You know, this is very funny. It's great. I'm glad I'm here, but, you know, you ain't going to be my doctor. So that was my, you know, that was the feeling I had of the 2 week teaching session. And after that, we were farmed out to the various clinics that were set up by this entrepreneur. So the way it worked was, because the Koreans were not allowed to be part of practicing medicine, they couldn't even go into the room where the patients were coming for treatment. What they could do is they could look through a window into the room where the patient was, so they could see the patient, and that was the best day. So there was no sound, they could just get a visual, and then I would be in the room, do the diagnosis, basically, you know, the looking and the touching and et cetera, and I would get the patient's story, and then I would draw, they had a little pre-printed stick sheets of, you know, stick men, stick figures, and I would draw where, so most of the patient's complaints were pain of one sort or another, more than anything else. I would draw little X's where it hurts here, it hurts there, on the stick figures. Then I would come out of the treatment room into a conference room with the Korean practitioners through a translator and show them the stick figures, tell them what the patient said, and they would get another stick figure and show me, okay, stick needles here, 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 and here, and leave them for 20 minutes. Totally bananas. I thought, you know, this confirms my initial impression that this is crazy. Patients got better. I couldn't believe it. I was, you know, I was there for, you know, let's see, I don't even remember how long I worked in that. The initial clinic was in Beverly Hills. Anyway, it was months I was there, and the patients were getting better from things that Western medicine had no real good way of treating, like migraines and arthritis and, yeah, you name the common things that hurt people, back pain, that kind of thing. So that really made my eyes pop open. It wasn't just that I liked it because it appealed to the things I didn't have access to in Western medical training, but it actually worked.
Yeah. So now it's not quite so bananas.
Exactly.
Or is it more bananas?
No, it wasn't more bananas. It actually was, this is really exciting.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is back in 1970, 73 is when I, at the end of, after finishing my internship, is when I started with this outfit in Los Angeles. So at that point, I decided I really want to find out more about this. I don't want just a two-week course. I want to find out what is this all about. And back in those days, there really was very little in English. You know, I was always an avid student, an avid reader. And so I decided I'll just read, you know, what's available. There were like four books in total that had anything to do with acupuncture. So, you know, there was Felix Mann's book. What else was there back in the day? When there was this really primitive translation by Ilse Weith of part of the Suwen. If you were lucky, you could get a copy of, I think it was available then, I could check later if the dates matter, of Wu Weiping's supposed book, Chinese Acupuncture, that was actually translated from Chinese into French by Jacques Lavier. Wu Weiping was sort of the master politician, practitioner in Taiwan of Chinese medicine and of acupuncture, basically. I don't remember how much of an herbalist he was, but he was a political figure, and also he was the official teacher for J.R. Worsley. Wu Weiping granted Worsley his doctorate, and Worsley and his traveling companion at the time went through this whole ritual of getting accepted as disciples of Wu Weiping. So Jacques Lavier, a French person who studied with Wu Weiping, translated into French the textbook, but that textbook didn't have Lavier's main interest in Chinese medicine and acupuncture, which was the five-element theory. Didn't have anything about that. And so he took it upon himself to write a chapter for Wu Weiping's book on the five elements, and then showed it to Wu Weiping and said, "Do you mind if I put this in your book for the Western world?" And Wu Weiping said, "Sure, go ahead and do that."
So that didn't come from Wu Weiping. That was a French creation.
It was a French creation that then got translated into English by Philip Chancellor, who was a Mexican acupuncturist. It's crazy the way these things work. But Philip Chancellor had also gone to Wu Weiping to get, they all kowtowed, Worsley, his traveling companion, Malcolm Stemp, and Philip Chancellor, I have pictures of this, they all kowtowed to Wu Weiping as part of the traditional discipleship entrance.
So an aspect of the medicine that has come into the West, it actually came through Taiwan. It came through Wu Weiping, a portion of it, a stream of it.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, where did the French fellow, where did he get the five element piece?
So Jacques Lavier was a very interesting fellow. He from a young age, taught himself Chinese, and he was interested in archaic Chinese, in the character, original characters, and what they meant. And I think he originally wanted to be a doctor, but ended up wasn't able to get into medical school, and he became a dentist, I believe, but was always interested in acupuncture. And I think that he got the five-element part of that, of his teaching about that. Let me just try to make sure I don't say this wrong. I believe that he got it from his own attempts at translating the Nei Jing, and there's a lot of five-element stuff in there. And then, this is really jumping the gun a lot, but many years later, I ended up writing a book on the history of acupuncture called In the Footsteps of the Yellow Emperor, in which I tried to reconstruct where all the different parts that in the West are taught, essentially around Worsley's contribution, but Worsley's contribution is mainly around the five elements.
Which he got from the Frenchman.
He got from Lavier, yes.
Lavier.
But where did Lavier get it from? That's where the big question mark came in, and I included a bunch of hypotheses and interviewed a lot of people trying to figure that out. And one of them that I decided finally was the answer was a, Ed Wong, W-O-N-G, was a Chinese practitioner who was involved in a number of international acupuncture conferences. And I believe that Ed Wong was the five-element teacher for Lavier at one of these, through one of these international acupuncture conferences.
Where were they having international conferences way back in the 70s?
Mm-hmm. Good question. So the backdrop to all of this is that acupuncture came to the West way before it came to the United States. And that's a big part that most American practitioners know nothing about. But Soulier de Meuron, that you've probably heard of,
mm-hmm.
was book. Yeah, giant book. I don't remember the date offhand of when he wrote the first part of that book. He actually died before it was completed, but he was a consul of sorts, a diplomatic consul from France to China, and was essentially the first real initiator of a legacy tradition of acupuncture in the West. There had been previous reports about acupuncture by other Westerners that go way back, even before Soulier de Meuron, but they didn't lead to an ongoing style of practice. They were just individual reports, whereas Soulier de Meuron had lots of followers, and still to this day, there are people who are essentially practicing Soulier de Meuron acupuncture.
Now, how did he get access to China at that time? Hadn't China cut off all relations with the West, or is this even before then?
They had, starting in the 1920s.
Oh, okay, yeah, it would have been open then, okay, yeah.
Yeah, so he was a political consul that basically was working on trade relationships, that kind of thing, as his profession. But while he was there, there was a cholera epidemic in China, and he had been somehow interested in acupuncture as something that was, you know, that was the kind of medicine that was available mainly in China. And he was observing a couple of different practitioners, I think originally one, but ended up being several. And the one he was observing had really great results with treating cholera patients. And so that's when he got real interested himself in saying, okay, I want to learn acupuncture. And so he studied with this one teacher and then other teachers in China and then later with teachers in Japan. And so he was really the initiator of acupuncture in the West, as far as I'm concerned.
And so it really came first to France.
Yes, it came first to France and then to other countries in Europe. Germany was pretty important in that lineage. And so this goes all the way back to the 20s, 30s, and 40s, if I'm remembering properly. I might be a little bit off in the dates, so it's been quite a while since I've really thought about that. But that was way prior to it arriving in the United States as a tradition. There were, of course, individual Chinese and other Asian practitioners in America all along,
sure.
You know, and they were practicing illegally as far as the various states were concerned, but because they mainly just treated their own country people, you know, other Asians, they usually were left alone. They weren't bothered. But I actually had an interaction that's relevant to that issue early on in my career as an acupuncturist, that one of the people I knew was Miriam Lee, who is well known among the acupuncture community in this country. So when she started practicing, she initially was mainly a Tong family style practitioner. When she started practicing, it was before there was any legal route for non-physicians to practice acupuncture, and she got arrested in California for practicing without a license. Just as an aside, it turned out that at some point in her career, I was her doctor, her Western medical doctor, so I got to know her a little bit through that. Eventually, what happened was there was so much of an uproar in California about Miriam Lee getting arrested because there was, at that point, there was a demand for her services. She was, you know, considered to be a very effective practitioner.
And probably both Asian descended people and American Caucasians, I suspect, were seeing her as well.
Yes, oh, definitely.
That's probably what partly stirred it up, I would suspect.
Yes, that is. And you know, both Miriam and I were practicing in Palo Alto, California. So, you know, we were neighbor, essentially neighbors. And what happened was that sometime later, I don't remember the duration in between, the next governor of California was Jerry Brown, got through legislation that first legalized the practice of acupuncture by non-physicians in California. And Miriam was, I think, like number three, if not number one. I think maybe she was number three of the licensees that finally got permission to practice legally in California.
Yeah, I suspect those listening to the conversation we're having here probably know of Miriam Lee. She's kind of in that pantheon of practitioners that you hear about from the early days. Now, okay, you're in L.A., you were doing this bananas acupuncture, and decide there's more to it. Start reading the very few books. Did you get a hold of the Wu Ping Wei book?
Wu Wei Ping. Yeah, I still have it.
Oh, you still have it?
Of course.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm a big book collector. I have all the early books.
Well, that would be kind of a, that's like a relic these days.
You can probably get it on the, you know, the rare bookseller things. Mm-hmm. It probably costs you a pretty penny more than it did back then, but I'm sure it's available.
Okay. So you read that.
I read that.
You read the Felix Mann.
I read Felix Mann. Ilse Weiss's Partial Su Wen.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it was at that point, but not too long after that, I managed to get a hold of a bunch of books by Dennis and Joyce, I think, Lawson Wood, who were English practitioners of various alternative medical styles. And the other book that was around then was Mary Austin's book. I think it was just called Acupuncture. I'll have to check back on that. But Mary Austin's book was essentially written by Dennis Lawson Wood.
Who was Mary Austin?
So Mary Austin was a medical doctor in England who wrote one of the first books about acupuncture that described the things like the transfer protocols for that Worsley incorporated in his approach to how to balance the elements in giving acupuncture treatment. And Mary Austin was, because I, in the research I did for putting my history book together in the footsteps of the Yellow Emperor, I tried to interview everybody that I could about it. And Mary was one of the few people that I never was able to get to say, yes, I will let you interview me. And from the other people that I interviewed, I think Mary is already deceased. Almost everybody from that whole story is deceased, so it's a little easier for me to talk about them now without hurting anybody's feelings. But one of the other people I interviewed knew Dennis Lawson Wood pretty well. And so I was able to interview. He had a early onset or mid onset Alzheimer's at that time. But I interviewed his wife, who was the co-author with him of the book. And both of them pretty much corroborated my sources information that they were the real authors of Mary Austin's book about acupuncture, which she never copped to.
So they were quite influential.
They were very influential. Yeah, Lawson Wood was very influential. And in fact, Lawson Wood was hired by the inheritor of Soulier de Meurant's tradition in France on the medical side. I don't know how much you know of the story of what happened in France. Yeah, it was really an important and a terrible story and a warning for the future. So Soulier de Meurant was obviously not a physician. He was a lay practitioner, but he ended up treating lots of the glitterati in France, Jean Cocteau among them, lots of famous people, and he had a very successful practice. And he taught a bunch of disciples that wanted to learn from him, one of whom, he was a medical doctor that decided after learning from Soulier de Meurant that acupuncture should only be practiced by physicians. And he actually ended up bringing up Soulier de Meurant on legal charges.
Hello, everyone. Anne Cecil Sturman here. A working knowledge of the 8 extraordinary channels from the unbroken oral tradition of acupuncture is valuable beyond words. The power of these channels is tremendous if the practitioner has well integrated diagnostic, theoretical, and practical skill. You'll be familiar with Dumai, the governor channel, or the Sea of Yang, the primal reservoir of Yang, which ultimately finances all movement and growth. But this channel also governs the ability to self-determine. The psycho-emotional presentation of your patients can be matched to a classical activation of this channel, clearing impedance in the free flow of Yang Qi to body, mind, and spirit. I'd like to share with you the marvelous potency of the Du channel in a full-length live treatment video from the seminar I taught last year in Melbourne, Australia. It's at annececilsturman.com/sinews2024. Click on the Jump to Free Teaching button or see the link on my Instagram page at Anne Cecil Sturman. Thanks, Michael. Back to you.
The guy who he learned from.
Yep.
He brought him up on legal charges.
Yep.
For not being a doctor.
Yep. For practicing without being a doctor. Yeah.
And teaching him without being a doctor.
Not for teaching, but for...
But for practicing.
For practicing. Ouch. Yeah. Why am I blocking on his name? It'll come to me. It'll come to me. Anyway, this other person turned out to be the leader of the medical acupuncture tradition in France, which... turned out to be, you know, in France, you actually, maybe even, it might still be the case, I haven't checked lately, you had to be a physician in order to be legally allowed to practice acupuncture. I think it is still the case.
It might still be the case.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about Koreans behind a slot with stick figures.
No, not at all. These are people that have studied for years and years and are some of the finest practitioners were. I mean, like I said, the original people that I learned about, they're all gone by now. They've died years ago.
I remember a book on rheumatology that came from the French Dr. Acupuncture.
Yeah,
put out by Eastland Press.
Yeah.
I read it when I was in school, and it was my first glimpse into really looking the dynamics of the great channels. Like the tie-in system, lung and spleen, or the Xiaoyang system, triple burner and gallbladder, and really seeing these as something more than just, oh, a hand channel, a foot channel, but these greater warps that move through the body really opened my mind up in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that happened in my career was I'm skipping over the whole period for the moment of when I studied with Worsley, when I studied with my Korean teachers, just to give you a flavor of, as background, that I studied many different styles of acupuncture. And because I was known for that, the American medical acupuncture group, which was started by Joe Helms, brought over people from France as the main teachers for physicians to learn acupuncture. And this person that you mentioned that wrote the book for Eastland Press on rheumatology was one of the people that Joe Helms was bringing over to teach. And one of the things that he taught was a system called the barrier point system.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So the barrier point system was real confusing for many of the physician students in the acupuncture program that Joe Helms set up. Joe knew me for many years prior to that as someone who had studied lots of different systems. And when his students were asking him to please explain this barrier point system, this is Gerard Guillaume was the name of the author of the rheumatology art text that you're talking about. When the students were asking about this barrier point system, and Joe couldn't quite figure it out himself well enough to answer the questions, he came to me and he said, would you like to read all of our, I have, you know, recordings of all of the French teachers' lectures. Would you like to troubleshoot this and figure out the barrier point system and teach my students? So I said, sure, I'll do that. Sounds like fun. So I did that. I read through the whole thing, figured out what it was about, then taught at the UCLA program to try to help the students understand what the barrier points were about. And in the process, I got to know Gerard Guillaume among many of the other French teachers that Joe had brought over to the States, because I would get invited to their once a year or twice a year, I don't remember now, teaching program where the French teachers would come over, teach the UCLA student, and, you know, we all got to know each other. So how did I get on to that? Well, you mentioned Gerard Guillaume, you know, the
rheumatology
text. Yeah, in French text. So this is all part, they're all doctors, they're all MDs in France that are practicing legally. And then there's a whole giant subset, probably more practitioners than there are doctor practitioners, who are not legal. They practice sub rosa, they just do it. And, you know, every once in a while they get a fine, you know, somebody rats them out and they get a fine, slap on the wrist. It's usually, I don't think it's an enormous fine. And then they go back and practice again.
So there's a whole group of people practicing, air quotes here, illegally, but mostly the authorities turn a blind eye to it. Every now and then they shake them down.
Yeah, that's my understanding I know that's where it was.
We don't know
whether it's still
today.
Current or not. I don't want to make a definitive statement about.
Let's go back to your Worsleyan and Korean influence.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let me try to figure out and make this a coherent story. So I was in Los Angeles and Beverly Hills practicing for this entrepreneur in his clinic, along with some others.
Hang on one second. This entrepreneur, who is this guy? This sounds like a character.
He was a character. He's a retired OBGYN doctor who was basically a businessman more than anything else, never learned acupuncture himself. You know, he was looking for a business opportunity and thought, wow, acupuncture, you know, is the coming thing. And he set up this string of clinics throughout California, but he needed people to staff it. And the only people who knew how to practice were the Koreans, so he needed doctors to actually do the work. So that's how I got into it. Do I even remember his name offhand? No. you know, but it wouldn't matter because he never had anything to do with acupuncture. Mm-hmm. He was just a businessman.
He was a businessman. So amazing. I mean, it's just fascinating to me that this retired OBGYN would see this as an opportunity and have at it as an opportunist. And it sounds like it worked.
Yeah, yeah. I think he did well financially.
He saw clearly the opportunity.
Yeah, yeah. So I was, as I said, in the Los Angeles area at the time, but I wanted to come back to San Francisco where I had been living prior to getting the job. And because this entrepreneur had set up a string of clinics, which included clinics in the Bay Area, there was one in San Francisco and there was another one close by, I forget which of these suburban towns. It was, you know, not far away. So there were two in the local vicinity here. As soon as a place opened up, I got transferred by request from me to the San Francisco clinic. And the Korean person who was doing this teaching, you know, telling the doctors where to put the needles, his name at the time was Chae-Woo Yu. Later changed to Chae-Woo Lu because his elder brother changed the spelling of the last name. And in Korean society, the elders make the decisions. If he does it, you have to do it too. So anyway, he did that, and he eventually became an appointed member of the acupuncture examining board. I think that was the original name of the committee. Basically, the licensing agency in California. And actually, through him, I got appointed to that licensing board. So,
became your teacher.
Yeah. So, as I started practicing under his direction in this cockamamie clinic setting, I realized that he was more talented than any of the other teachers that I had so far encountered in Los Angeles. And at the time, there's an interesting story. I was, because you'll appreciate this personally, I was interested in all the alternative, you know, after I left Western medicine and found that acupuncture works, I said, well, what else didn't they teach me? Right. And I started...
what else is out here?
Exactly. I started studying everything, homeopathy and naturopathy and Western herbology and body work, Rolfing and...
It just opened you up, didn't it? It just like opened your mind.
Opened my mind up, yes. So, I clearly saw if they were withholding something from me that was so useful, there must be a lot more that they didn't tell me about. Anyway, so I got interested in all of this, and then I started teaching in this little pop-up institution called the Helix Center, which was basically a way of teaching alternative medicine to anybody that was interested. So, once a week I had a class in anatomy and physiology for people who practiced alternative medicine and were interested in learning Western anatomy and physiology. And lo and behold, it was a small class, maybe there were, I can't remember, 5 or 6 to 10 people at most in the class. It was different each week. Most of the people in the class were just, they'd write notes and occasionally ask a question. Didn't make an impression on me one way or the other. One of the students in the class, however, always, every single time, asked me a question that either stumped me or made me do a double take of, gee, I never thought of it that way, or, I have to figure out how to answer.
What a great student to have, huh?
And his name was Stuart Cutchins. That's how I met Stuart. That's how I met Stuart, and we became close friends. We just glommed onto each other. We just saw something in each other that was so attractive. And Stuart was at the time also learning acupuncture from a Japanese teacher, but looking for a more extensive teaching experience. And when he learned that I was very impressed with my Korean teacher in the Bay Area, here in around San Francisco, he said, well, why don't you see if he's interested in actually teaching us as formal students. So actually, Stuart, I, and a friend of Stuart's decided we were willing to invest the money if Che would teach us, and he agreed. And so I forget how long, I think it was at least a year, every weekend we spent a day studying with him. And that eventually ended up with Stuart and I doing a discipleship with Che for over 10 years.
So that turned into a long-term...
long-term relationship.
Long-term relationship.
And he was a very talented acupuncturist. I mean, I could tell lots of stories about that, including my own experience of being treated by him. But he unfortunately got involved in a rather shameful experience because he was on the California Acupuncture Board. There was a situation where he was kind of pressured by Korean elders to mess around with the exam, and he eventually did time in prison for corruption, for letting answers to the test go to these very high influential Korean masters who didn't speak English and couldn't, you know, didn't want to take tests. You know, they were old people. They weren't. It's the kind of thing where you could understand there was a cultural clash mm-hmm. where in Korea this would have been perfectly okay to have done.
Not so much here.
But not so much here.
Yeah, not here.
And it was a very painful experience for myself. I don't want to even speak for Stuart. And for Che, who's no longer with us, he's passed on. But I learned an enormous amount from him. Stuart did as well. And it's just one of those things that, you know, are life-changing, where you have to realize that there are so many aspects to a human being, some of which are at the height of the most open-hearted person you'll ever meet. I'll do anything for you to, on some level... yeah, I'll lie to you, I'll cheat, I'll steal. Because he would never admit to us that this was going on, that he was doing this underhanded stuff. And it was partly because of he was trapped. You know, he was trapped between these two cultures.
Trapped between cultures, trapped between influences. What's the word that I'm searching for here? Because, like, helping out your countrymen who need help, that's also considered... You know, Peter, I'm so glad you bring this up. We're having this conversation at a moment in our culture where everything is so darn black and white at the moment, and vehemently so. And it's a helpful reminder that we are incredibly complex beings. We are incredibly contradictory beings.
And I hope that, you know, this is the first time I've really talked at any length about Che. And I hope that the outcome of this will be some sort of rehabilitation of his reputation. That I don't want to in any way excuse what he did. It was wrong. No question about it being mm-hmm. wrong. And he did his time. I mean, mm-hmm. I visited him in prison. I'm one of the few people I know who visited him in prison because I really cared for him.
And you learned a lot from him.
I learned an enormous amount from him. And... more than that, even more important, is I got introduced into the upper echelon of Korean acupuncturists. I've studied since, because of him, with the initiator or inventor of Korean hand acupuncture, Yoo Tae-woo, and became his spokesperson who set up all of his classes in America for many years. And also, with Stuart, became one of the only foreigners ever to have been invited to study under Guan Dawan, who is the initiator and inventor of Korean constitutional acupuncture, which is essentially an application of the Sa'am technique that you are more familiar with now, with the four needle technique that in Korean constitutional acupuncture was much earlier as something that practitioners could learn about than what's now being taught as Sa'am acupuncture, that I have a little bit of a hesitation about the nomenclature for. You know, I understand there are reasons why it's being taught that way now, But I kind of think that it would have been much better if they had chosen some other word. Now, I'll explain why. It's kind of like when Worsley, whom we'll get to if we have time, decided to call what he his style of practice, when I first started studying with him, traditional Chinese acupuncture.
That's what he called it back then.
Traditional Chinese. Well, that was the name of his college, the College of Traditional Chinese Acupuncture.
Mm-hmm.
And that was where I got my first level degree in acupuncture from. But, you know, that's crazy to glom on to your particular style as being the tradition, and that everybody else is doing something that's not traditional. In the same way, to call what is now being taught as Sa'am acupuncture kind of says to me, in many ways, the other people who use what Sa'am taught, but very differently than how they're doing it, are not practicing Sa'am acupuncture.
Ah, okay.
So I would have preferred if they said something, called it something like, well, either the name of the initiator of this style, who's modern, you know, I mean, he's still alive, I believe, right? You would know better than I do.
The tradition that I've been exposed to, I've learned it from a fellow named Toby
From
Daly.
Toby, yeah.
And he learned it from a monk that he met while he was traveling.
Right, who is still alive, right?
Who's still alive but not in touch.
Okay, but there's another, you know, there's now this Facebook group called the Sa'am. Are you aware of that? You should be, probably. Sa'am acupuncturist?
I probably should be. I've only recently become aware of the Facebook group. I don't spend a huge amount of time on that. So.
Okay, well, I think that Toby's influence is showing up. I think it's the same teacher, same teachings that got transmitted.
So tell me a little bit. Now, this is... This could be a 2 or 3 part conversation with you, Peter Edmund. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the constitutional Korean acupuncture and the Sa'am is it, well. This is like a 3 part question. Sa'am is you've understood it through your own learning, and then Sa'am is kind of being popularized. I've actually had a hand in that.
So lots of different. Ways I could go about this. Just give me 1 second. I'm still upset that I can't bring the French doctor's name immediately to mind. It will come to me, but it's all documented in my history book, so anybody who's interested, just read In the Footsteps of the Yellow Emperor. It's all in there.
In recent years, the Sa'am acupuncture style has generated significant interest and a loyal and growing following. In the Sa'am approach, a precise diagnosis leads to a 4-needle treatment to address the 5-element and 6-chi imbalances in the body. The 4 needles target the controlling and generating cycles. It's common using this method for the needle sensation to be stronger than in many other styles. Thus, the choice of needle becomes important. The Unico brand of needles lends itself to both strong and gentle techniques. These superior needles are made of uncoated Japanese surgical stainless steel and feature the best guide tube on the market with its unique beveled edge. Additionally, Unico needles have a tensile property that helps with freehanding needles into Jingwell points and allows you to more easily feel the arrival of qi. Blue Poppy is the exclusive importer and distributor of Unico needles. Use the code QI2024 to save 10% off Unico needles at www.bluepoppy.com. You'll be glad you did. Fabulous book, by the way. I remember reading it when I was in acupuncture school. It was like a detective novel. It is. It's a detective novel.
Yeah, and even the illustration is me as Sherlock Holmes in there.
Yes.
Yeah. So to try to answer your question, I studied with the Korean teachers, including the ones that I've just mentioned to you, initially. When I got to San Francisco, I came into a meeting with the local practitioner, acupuncture practitioners, the main one of whom was a graduate of Worsley School in England. And he actually was my first, he became my practitioner, my first practitioner. He's sadly passed on now, but he was a very influential figure. Hal Balin was his name. He was a medical doctor who was in Worsley's first class teaching foreigners, mainly Americans.
Yeah. In England, we would be the foreigners.
Yeah. And Hal Balin lived on a houseboat in Sausalito, which is near in the Bay Area here. And he used to have host meetings of local acupuncturists to share case histories and, you know, get to know each other and that kind of stuff. And at one of them, I met another one of these doctors who were fellows of mine that had come from this original Los Angeles doctor's training program. Haig Ignatius also lived in the Bay Area here. And Haig, who later went on to be a founding member of the TAI, the Traditional Acupuncture Institute in Maryland, which was a Worsley-style school, Haig had heard about Worsley, again, probably through Hal Balin, but maybe from several other people, and had heard that Worsley was going to give a public lecture in San Francisco. Was I interested in going? And so I ended up going to that.
Of course. And anything acupuncture, I suspect you'd be in on it.
Yeah. And I was quite taken with it. You know, it was a very stirring lecture. And I decided to find out, okay, since there's only a limited amount, I realized that I was limited in what I could learn from Che in the Korean style, and that there was a lot more out there. And so I wanted to find out what Worsley had to offer, since I was impressed with Hal and the other Worsley graduates that I had met, and decided, okay, I will apply to the school at the same time that Haig did, because Haig said, I'm going. Do you want to come?
Mm-hmm.
So I applied, and it's interesting. My
now this is before or after you were doing your study with the Korean teacher?
Simultaneous. Both. Yep.
Man, you're in with both feet.
In with both feet. So I spent 10 years with both of them, 10 years with Worsley, 10 years with the Che Lu.
You're studying two traditions simultaneously.
So, and it's important that you brought that up, because when I applied to study with Worsley, the first thing he said to me is, you know what? I think you've got what it takes, and I'd love to have you as my student. But one condition, you have to promise me that you will not put another needle in a patient until you finish my licentiate level course. And I say, you're a graduate, you can go back to practicing acupuncture. And that really threw me.
I'll bet it. I mean, that's a big commitment.
That's a big commitment.
Wow.
And I said, okay, I'll get back to you. I'm not going to make a spot decision on it right now. I have to think about this, because that's how I earned my living that way. And
yeah, and you've got your teeth into this.
I've got my teeth into it.
Other thing, and it's got some depth to it.
Yep. So I thought about it, and then I decided, you know what? I've already grappled with giving up things in order to get what I want out of life. One of the things I've given up, for instance, is guitar playing, because the strings made my fingers calloused, and I felt like, you know, what's the point of trying to learn a practice that, as far as I was concerned from reading what I had read, was based on pulse diagnosis as a very important part of being an acupuncturist. When you have calluses on your fingers, that's crazy. And my guitar teacher had been Dave Van Ronk, who was a big name in the Greenwich Village folk music scene. And he really thought I had, you know, great promise as a guitar, you know, folk singer, guitar player. So that was a big, hard thing, but I eventually decided I'm going to do it. I really would rather learn to be a good acupuncturist than have recreational guitar playing in my life. It was a hard decision, but it was one that I was willing to make.
So you came to this inflection point. You recognize, all right, this is bifurcation.
Yep.
I can move forward with one.
Yep. So it's the same thing happened with what Worsley offered me, and I decided, okay, I'll do it. You know, it's only a year. I can figure out how to grapple with that. And I did it. Mm-hmm. I kept my promise. I got my lick act from Worsley, and I went back to practicing. So let's see what your question was about the constitutional side of this. As part of your question, Worsley's style is very much based on what I call people's constitutions. Worsley never called it that. He called it what he was trying to get people to diagnose the CF. And it's really interesting that this very day I have been in correspondence with a person in England who I shall keep nameless because I don't want to get anybody currently alive in trouble. But there's a dispute going on right now about who is allowed to use the words causative factor and CF. The lineage holder in England of Worsley's teachings is rather strict about her legal right to determine who can teach Worsley style acupuncture and who can use certain terminology that she claims Worsley invented and trademarked or has the intellectual property rights to. So it's, somebody came to me asking for help, wanting to write a book that would use some of that terminology, and could I help, please help figure out how to deal with that? So it's interesting. It just happened within the last 2 days, and today was part of that online conversation with a colleague in England. Anyway, not an important point, just interesting how these things come together.
Well, it is interesting how these things come together. And, you know, when I think of the medical language of acupuncture, I mean, it's a very specific subset of, you know, words and ways of speaking and ways of thinking. It's hard to imagine patenting a medical idea for something that is thousands of years old. Spans all kinds of time and tradition.
Yes. I would agree with you 100%, but I also recognize that when people come up with some new way of configuring things, it's their prerogative to say, I've come up with this new way. If you want to use it, you need my permission to use this.
Or intellectual property.
Yeah, exactly. It's a question of intellectual property rights. We human beings vary tremendously in how they approach that kind of problem. For me, I've had so many insights about acupuncture that I've never seen anywhere else. And I teach it freely and tell people, go use it and teach it yourself. You know, it's not mine. I just saw it. You know, and I want everybody to have it. Other people feel, no, this took a lot of work to get to. This is mine to do with as I want. You know, that's for everybody to decide for themselves. That's anyway. To jump back to the real question, Worsley didn't ever call it constitution. He called it causative factor, which he abbreviated as CF, and I believe that's what the intellectual property right argument is about, is the use of the abbreviation CF. There is some further arguments, but that's the main one. So my take personally, and you know, you can see this in my history book that we've been talking about, is I feel that the causative factor is actually a constitutional aspect of human nature, that it's something you're conceived with, born with, live with and die with. It never changes. It's part of your biology. And Worsley did not believe that. He himself said he didn't know at what age it became, the CF became part of a person's life, but from then on, it didn't change most of the time. He did occasionally, almost never, but occasionally, in my memory at least, admit that there might be circumstances where it could change, but it was very rare, and that it probably came into existence at the latest in early childhood. Okay, that was his take. I've treated it as constitution. So when I went to England to study with Worsley and felt this constitutional symbolism as an important part of what an acupuncturist tries to discover about his patients, and then came across the teachings of Korean constitutional acupuncture by Gwan Dawan, the person that I said I went to study with Stuart, I recognized those were the only two sources where I recognized people thinking about constitution as an important aspect of acupuncture diagnosis, meaning constitution as that which you're born with or conceived with, rather than, you know, like a big, strong, muscular person has a strong constitution and somebody with TB has a frail constitution. No, that's a different use of the terminology. What we're talking about here is something you come into life with and keep throughout your whole life. And I think that's very important, and it eventually became my own style of practice that I made a name up for, which is constitutional conditional acupuncture, because what most practitioners do is they look at what's going on now. What is this person's current state, which I call their condition, that has to do with their organ functions, how are they relating to each other right now, with their yin and yang, what is their status with that right now, that balance, with everything else. All of that is not their constitution. It's what's going on right now that I have to treat to get them better.
Against the background of the constitution.
Well, I believe it is, but that's not the common teaching in acupuncture schools or schools of thought. So I had these two teachers that had a constitutional point of view, and then all these other people that practiced acupuncture from what I call a conditional point of view. And what I came to is, for myself, is the idea that when we come into life, we start out with a particular configuration of our energetics on every level. And that's just a reflection of who we are. That's our original nature. And we feel like ourselves when we're keeping that original nature because that's who we are. That feels, we call that being healthy. Doesn't mean you don't have problems, but that's being healthy. If because of any outside or inside disruption, you lose that original orientation, you then don't have your original nature anymore. You're thrown off of it, and you don't feel as well. You don't feel like yourself.
Literally, you don't feel like yourself. People say this all the time. Exactly. You treat them, they start feeling better. They're like, oh, I feel like myself again.
Right. So the key there for me is the goal of acupuncture for me is to encourage a person to go from their conditional state back to their constitutional state. That's what acupuncture is about for me. So it involves two things that an acupuncturist doing my kind of work has to do is, one, figure out what is each person's original nature, and two, what is their current conditional state. Once I know that, then there are various strategies to encourage, remind them how to go back to where they came from.
Your word here, remind, that totally rings a bell for me. People often ask me after a particularly, I'm going to say, poignant treatment, you know, they feel a certain way. Again, they say they feel like themselves. You can see a look in their eye. The feeling in the room changes. The pulse changes. They're complete. I mean, everything. And they'll often ask, like, what did you do? What's happening here? And it's a troublesome question to answer for me.
Well, now you have a good answer.
I mean, again, yeah, this makes sense. Because what I say to them is, look, they'll often ask me, what did you put on those needles? The answer is there's nothing on the needles. Acupuncture can only call out something that's innate with you. It helps remind you who you are. I actually use those words. It just helps remind you who you already are. And that answer is usually very satisfying for me.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you came to that, apart from me telling you that you've been doing that yourself too.
So you had these two different teachers that looked at constitution.
Did they map together?
Nope.
That's why I spent years and years and years trying to figure out the relationship between those two and how to make sense of it all. Even before trying to figure out the conditional side of, okay, that's a whole nother kettle of fish, but trying to make the constitutional side work out. So I ended up frustrated at many points so that I couldn't do it. Because my particular nature is I'm sort of like a bulldog. What do you call it? Those kind of dogs that you bite down and never let go. Anyway, I'm like...
You're a Rottweiler.
Rottweiler. So I look for every possible way of resolving something that's puzzling me. And I came up with two things that really helped. One was the studying with this other Korean teacher of hand acupuncture, Yoo Tae-woo, who has a system of abdominal diagnosis that helps you understand what the various organ systems are like in terms of which ones are too strong and which ones are too weak. That helped me. And then the other thing is, even with those in hand, I still wasn't able to get anywheres. I decided that, you know, I've heard stuff about Ayurvedic medicine that has always intrigued me, and I actually ended up teaching at an enormous, I mean, this was supposed to be about the good old days. In the good old days when acupuncture was first getting started, there was a big conference in Washington, D.C. with a number of very famous people. Yeshe Dondon was the doctor to the Dalai Lama, was a presenter at that conference. Manfred Porkert, who wrote the first technical book about
this is in the
Chinese
70s,
medicine.
I guess?
Yep, this is okay. I could look it up, but I think it's around 1976, something like that. Who else was there? That guy who did the physics, Tao of physics, Fritjof Capra. Was a speaker at that. I was a speaker at that. Stuart Cutchins was a speaker at that. Father Père Claude Laure was a speaker at that. That's actually how I got into learning a little bit of Chinese, was through meeting Claude Laure at that, because his whole thing was anybody can learn Chinese. I can teach anybody to learn Chinese. And I said, oh, yeah, over my dead body, you can. I had a class with him, and I started learning Chinese. He was right. And we became great friends, and we co-taught classes together. We took a trip to China together. Yeah.
It is possible.
It is possible, yeah. Yep. It is possible. It's hard work. Anyway.
Anything worthwhile usually is.
Yeah. So how did I get onto that? Something about...
You were trying to...
So because of Yeshe Dondon and, you know, having some respect for Indian medicine, I decided that, okay, this is... I had a feeling that the pulses were the key to all of this, being able to figure it out, that all the different styles came back to pulse diagnosis of their tradition. And the one that I didn't know anything about was Ayurvedic pulse diagnosis, but I knew it was a thing. And so I searched and I found a good, really good teacher of Ayurvedic pulse diagnosis, Mary Jo Cravatta, who was in the Bay Area. And so I spent, I think it was a couple of years studying pulse diagnosis with her. And that was the missing link that I needed to find what I call a Rosetta Stone that allows me to transfer information from Chinese medicine to Indian medicine to Korean medicine in all its various iterations. And so I use all of them, every patient, in trying to figure out what is a person's constitution. And I don't think I ever could have done that without having those, all those branches feeding me information from the Neijing to the Nanjing to the Meijing to the Ayurvedic system to the Korean systems. All of that together, I was finally able to harmonize and understand how they, what they meant. And that's what I teach when I go. And so I've been invited to teach even in China. I've taught three workshops in China where eventually it's very different than the way I'm used to people teaching classes and workshops. You know, usually what they do is, you know, there's a bunch of talking and they may treat somebody and, you know, they temporarily feel better after being here. I was the attending physician, like in my medical training, for a period of 3 to 5 days in a row where I had to treat everybody that came for treatment, but they had to come back every day to report. So it's not just they feel better for a moment or for an hour.
They come back and they give you information.
Yeah, they have to come back day after day after day and report them. Are you still doing better?
So you can see the progression.
Exactly.
Not just, here's a great idea. You feel good. Most people feel good after an acupuncture treatment. How are you 3 or 4 days later?
Exactly. And so that was a wonderful experience to me, and that's how I teach now. I'm planning to continue teaching in the future, too, is always to have it be an ongoing situation where people can see the actual transformation in people, not just momentary relief of suffering, mm-hmm. which is worth something, but it's not, for me, it's not the ball game.
So your sense of constitution at this point...
Mm-hmm.
It's not just what Worsley taught.
Nope.
It's not just what you got from your Korean teachers.
Nope.
It's a synthesis of that plus pulse, plus whatever else you brought into it, your reading of the classics. You've got your own sense of what constitution means at this point.
Yes. I'm not sure that it's different than what my Korean teacher thought it meant. It's just I've expanded the possibilities. He only had 8 constitutions, and I believe there are 20 constitutions.
20 constitutions.
20 unique constitutions.
I wish you were going to say there was only 8 because that makes life easier.
Yes, it does. It made it easier for him, and he never gave that up. Even mm-hmm. he practiced well into his 90s and only died at the age of 101, having retired, 4 or 5 years prior to his death.
So you can practice quite well with 8 constitutions.
Yeah, well, my experience, and I think Stuart will back me up with this since we studied with him together, is, you know, when he was right, he was phenomenal. Mm. When he was wrong, he was wrong. You know, it's not, and that's true with everybody I've ever studied with. You know, nobody's 100%.
No. So 20 constitutions. Okay, I think that's probably a conversation for another day.
Yep, it is.
But before we wind this one down, could you speak a little bit to the Sa'am piece?
Okay, I'm going to do 2 things. One is the Sa'am piece, but something has to come before that, which is around the 1980s is when the introduction of Chinese medicine as it's codified in TCM or any of the other various styles entered my awareness and the awareness of acupuncturists in America. Prior to that, it wasn't a thing. And there was a real conflict between the 5-element people under Worsley and the people getting their teaching from China who were in the 8-principle camp, and they hated each other. They just fought like lions about, you know, Worsley kept denigrating the Chinese approach, you know, the 8-principle approach, and the 8-principle people laughed at the 5-element people and said, oh, Worsley just made that whole thing up. It has nothing to do with Chinese medicine. It was very antagonistic. And my process throughout has always been to try to find the middle ground, the harmony that allows what's real from both sides to be in the pot that we're all eating from. And so that took 10 years for that to finally start to get resolved. And that meeting in Washington where all those people I mentioned gave speeches was a very influential point at which things began to switch to from fighting to respect for each other and a sense that it doesn't have to be my way. This is my way, but it doesn't mean your way is wrong. So I'm going to leave that. So for Sa'am, even from my earliest studies of Korean acupuncture, I got, you know, whatever was available in English that started coming out, I saw references to Sa'am, and they always were exactly the same. They were Sa'am discovery. He was a Buddhist monk in the medieval times who discovered, after meditating in a cave, the four needle technique, which involved using the promoting and controlling sequences of the five elements to make the most powerful effect on transforming the energetics of whatever meridian system you were treating. That plus, so one was promoting and controlling for excess and deficiency. And then as a side note, he had also a secondary one that's in all of the literature about him that was about heating and cooling. People that are too hot and people that are too cold, how to treat that, again, with four needles. So I always thought that what Sa'am acupuncture really was about, the core of it, was the four needle, the use of a four needle combination to try to influence the energetics that were at play. The more modern thing that now is being called Sa'am acupuncture includes other teachings about emotions and climatic conditions, et cetera, that as far as I knew were not in any of the stuff that I had ever seen about Sa'am. Doesn't mean that they weren't there. Maybe they were in Korean, and they may be right, but lots of styles like Korean constitutional acupuncture are based on the four needle technique as the type of treatment. And they have nothing to do with this modern stuff that is being taught as Sa'am acupuncture. So I feel a little uncomfortable about Sa'am acupuncture claiming the territory of if people do something different, they're not doing Sa'am acupuncture. I think they were. Korean constitutional acupuncture wouldn't be without Sa'am acupuncture.
You wouldn't have it without the four needle technique.
Exactly.
Right. So it comes.
Exactly. Every single treatment he did was with the four needle technique. Yeah.
Well, it seems to me, I've just watched human beings for 60 some odd years now, being one myself. And one of the things I notice is we tend to identify with things, or we want to, especially these days, like you want to brand yourself or associate yourself with this. I'm not like that. I'm this. You know, we don't do that. We do this. There's always this schismogenic thing that's going on. And beyond that, you know, sometimes there's these similarities that run through things. So it's really helpful hearing your perspective on this, because I think it, for me, it helps me to better understand where the knowledge that's come down to me, where it's come from. Because, look, you can get things in books, and these days we're lucky to have so darn many, not to mention you can open up your computer and there's videos and there's podcasts and, I mean, so many ways of learning something. But still, it's come from someone, through someone, to someone else. And how we choose to identify with that or not identify with it, you know, we get to tell all kinds of stories about it. So it's just helpful to hear your perspective, especially, Peter, because you have looked at so many different aspects of the tradition.
Mm-hmm. Over 50 years.
Over 50 years.
Of being a practitioner. That's another thing that I want to point out is that of my teachers, not a lot of them stopped practicing way before I've been practicing as long, you know, they became teachers rather than practitioners. And my whole thing has always been, I'm a practitioner. Yeah, I'll teach you what I think I've learned. I'm happy to do that. But if I stop practicing, I stop learning. And I'm not even so sure I can still maintain the statements that I think are correct because I don't have feedback. So for me, primarily, I'm a practitioner. Secondarily, I'm a teacher.
And that's where your knowledge comes from.
Yeah, my knowledge comes from my practice.
That, I think, is a good place to put a pin in it for today. But I'd love to come back and continue the conversation.
Sure, anytime.
Of course, East Asian medicine was here in the West long before folks from the mainstream culture began to cotton to it. And I, for one, like to imagine a history of Zhenren-type doctors working through their virtue to relieve suffering in the world. So when the story gets bigger, when I hear about a retired OBGYN who creates a franchise of Korean doctors doing acupuncture by proxy using Western MDs who have the legal authority to use needles, well, it reminds me that the human spirit and imagination are indeed vast. And in service of scratching out a living, people get mighty creative. And at the same time, even with the foibles and imperfections of some of Peter's teachers, there was also the transmission of helpful knowledge and skill to a younger generation of practitioners that occurred. And we're also the beneficiaries of that. Peter's inquiry into constitution and condition, that constitution is something that we are. And when we live through that blueprint, we have access to the resources and capacities that allow us to more fully interact in the world. Our constitution, it's not a compensation. It's our wellspring. It's in the times when we're working from a conditional adaptation that is when we lose connection to our unique vitality. Coming home to who we are and how we are, that is something worth aiming at. Thanks as always for listening. If you liked this conversation, if you learned something new or found a moment of inspired insight, share the episode with your friends. If you want to support Geological, there's just one way to do that. It's by going to the website and becoming a member or leaving a one-time contribution today. Well, folks, that's it for today. Join us again next Tuesday for another conversation that connects up the voices of our community.